We'd like to welcome you to the Heart Leader Podcast, where heart and mind align. I'm your host, Amber, and I'm here with co-host Austin, and we'd like to know, do you have a passion to make a greater global impact? Are you ready to embrace leading with heart and love? If so, join us on this journey to become heart leaders who change the world. Each episode brings heart-centered connection, building stronger relationships, communities, and businesses. Let's take a deeper dive into what it means to be heart leaders. The Heart Leader Podcast starts now. Hi, and welcome to the Heart Leader Podcast, where heart and mind align. I am your host, Amber, and I am here today with Rangeena Hamidi. This fantastic light in our world has done so much to be a voice for those who have not had an opportunity to be a voice for themselves. Her story is one that touched my heart so deeply that when she agreed to be on this podcast, I honestly cried. So in a rare opportunity to bring such a light into our podcast, I'm not going to spend much time introducing her because I want to give her an opportunity to share her heroic story and all she's done for women and just people around the world in general through this voice that we have had an opportunity to bring forward. So Rangeena, thank you so much for being here, first and foremost. It's an honor for us, and our community is just blessed to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And I'm no hero, just a human being doing what I'm called to do.
And that humble nature is a gift. But a hero is someone to me that steps forward in a time of great need and provides a service that others are not able to, or that others step away from. And that's exactly what you did. Can you share a little bit about that journey?
I'll begin the journey because the question was asked of me in 2003 when I decided to go back to my birth country of Afghanistan. I had freshly graduated from university and trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do with life. I did not go to a master's program right after college because I wanted to explore who I was and what interested me. So it took about a year or two to be able to do that. And when the opportunity came for Afghanistan to welcome back its children who had been living in the diaspora, and I did not leave my birth country of Afghanistan by choice. My parents were forced to flee the country in 1981 when I was about 4.5 years old to seek refuge after the, at that time, USSR invasion of my country. Going back in 2003 as a young adult by myself, as a single woman, and then choosing to go to my birth town of Kandahar, Afghanistan, which is the de facto capital of the Taliban. It definitely was in the 1990s when the Taliban first regime came to power. All my family and friends living in America questioned me, "Are you crazy? What are you doing? Why are you going? And if you do want to go, at least go to Kabul, which is a capital city, which is where the rest of the diaspora aspiring to go back was going." And the response that I naturally gave was, had my parents not made the decision to flee in the early 1980s, to give us the opportunity initially in Pakistan as refugees, and then you know, leaving Pakistan for a better future for his daughters, my father brought us to America to give us that opportunity. And deciding and wanting to go back in 2003 was only a natural calling for me, saying and viewing that if my parents had not made that decision back in the days when we were children, I could very well be one of the women that I decided to work for or with in Kandahar, because those women, lucky enough, or maybe not so lucky for many, who had survived the decades of war and destruction and control and, you know, being stopped to basically live and do what they wished and desired to do, I could have been one of those women. And so now that I had the opportunity to go back and help in the capacity that I could, of course, I'm not a prophet. I can't go and cause miracles to happen. But it was just a natural calling of the heart to say, go back and give, because I am able to. And that's what took me. And I did not know that my one little decision of standing up against all the people who were advising me not to would give me the rich experience of almost 20 years of my adult working life.
Yes, and that decision led to an amazing journey that somebody who met you today, I recently met you, and to see you as composed and strong and integrated into our culture as you are, one would never look at you and know what you navigated over the course of that 20 years. And to me, that's why it's so important to share this voice.
And I smile, mm-hmm. and I look happy, and I'm well. Physically, emotionally, but I do carry with me an incredible amount of pain, anger, agony, frustration, and distrust in the world of how political leaders across the world live with themselves, and how do they wake up every morning and look at the mirror in themselves, looking at themselves, and asking, our decisions are affecting millions of lives who are vulnerable, who are powerless. Powerless in their definition of the world. Of course, I never saw my people who have lived through so much suffering as powerless people. Because if they were powerless, they would not be living right now. They live a life of destruction and misery. And now, as we speak, a great majority of my country's children are on the brink of starvation because world politicians decided to just change courses, change the gear of where they thought they were headed, or where we thought as ordinary citizens we were headed in Afghanistan. And when Washington decided to change gears, the suffrage or the suffering that millions of children are now going through is a direct result of people making decisions that don't really speak to the heart. Because if these people really considered for a moment to try to understand the reality of what the people of Afghanistan are going through or were going through, I think they would have made different decisions. But the fact of the matter is, the decision is made now. I've been made a refugee again in my life. The third time, officially. The first time was when I was 4 and a half. We fled to go to our neighboring country, Pakistan. Then at about age 11-ish, I and my little sister were forced out of school, even though my father was completely fine with it. My family was completely fine with giving a future to his daughters. But the elements in the society that were funded and supported as the guerrillas against, you know, the Russian invaders in politics. And as a little child, I did not understand that then.
Not at all.
And so we were lucky enough to be threatened and warned not to go to school instead of having the common practice of acid on girls' faces to punish them. And so in that regard, I do consider myself lucky because the people who did not think that it was necessary for my sister and I to get an education came and warned my father, pull them out or else you'll see the consequences. And even though my father wanted to argue with them to say no, at least allow them to go up until sixth grade, you know, to get the basic literacy in place, my mother stood strong and said, no, I don't trust these people. I don't want my little girls defaced. And I don't want them going to school. So we got pulled out of school, and that then resulted in becoming a refugee for the second time from Pakistan to America, landing in the U.S. in 1988, and then choosing to go back in 2003 and being forced to flee, to evacuate my country that I thought I had, you know, come back to home. But that home was snatched away from many of us, hundreds and thousands and millions of us, again on August 15, 2021. And here I am in my adopted home of America, ever grateful for this second home that I have. And I consider myself an equal citizen both of Afghanistan as well as America. I was born there, but I was raised here. But somehow there's this inner calling where luckily America is a blessed country from a natural resource perspective, from economic perspective, from a political and development perspective. America has pretty much all the needs that we need in the world, and sometimes even more so.
And we forget this quite often.
Yes.
Take it for granted.
Exactly. And so I had chosen to go back and serve the country of my birth, which had nothing compared to America. And even in that nothingness, some people think that it was not worth to, not worth, some people thought that it was not necessary for people like myself to go and work. Put it simply as that.
Yeah. Why would you leave everything to go to nothing?
Because people judge. You know, we human beings, we judge things or we measure things in life with the material goods that surround us.
Yes.
And we never really look inside our hearts, our bodies, our souls to see, could material things ever fulfill the needs of the soul? And I, from my experience, I'm more than happy to share that Afghanistan had nothing and doesn't have anything. But there was a sense of peace that I had, an internal peace that I had serving humanity, serving my people, that I have a hard time finding in America, to be honest. There's wonderful, great people living in America. But the stress, this constant rush to do things, rush to be somebody or something always, even when you're not busy, you carry that stress with you. And I didn't have that stress then. Not only did I not have the stress, but I knew every day that every step that I took in my time in Afghanistan, whether it was working with women, you know, empowering them economically through working in a school where we were educating the future generation of Afghanistan, to coming and serving as Minister of Education, you know, overlooking a one of the largest ministries in the country, as well as serving close to 10 million children across the country. You know, just can't, the weight of that responsibility almost was weightless, in the sense that it felt like every step and every day that I spent on that cause felt like there was, that I was trying to make something happen. Whereas here, it's wonderful. I mean, I enjoy my life. I have all the things that one can need in life, but you just feel like, I don't know. There's, I think every human being, if you just listen to your heart tells you where you're at peace.
Yes.
And while I'm very comfortable in America, but my heart longs for something more, and that something more I have not been able to find yet in America.
Understandable. Our theme this month is very much about ego, which we often associate with, you know, there's a balance to that. Ego can be a tool, it can be a weapon, it can be what drives us to stress and always needing more to fill that longing that is really something internal. Or it can make us feel less than. Where do you feel ego fits in with what you've experienced between the political aspects, the lack of connection? Do you find that there is a need for balance, for understanding the tool versus weapon approach that can be found in ego?
I appreciate you stating that ego can be a tool. I have a hard time understanding where we can use it as a tool.
We don't do it often enough to like really understand that, but yes.
But I as a weapon, definitely. You know, I've actually studied religious studies and women's studies as my two majors during my bachelor years, many, many years ago. And when I studied the monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and I am of a Muslim faith. I'm a Muslim, so I follow the faith of Islam, and I practice it to the best of my ability. Am I a perfect, good Muslim? I am. I would not judge myself, because I don't know what a good, perfect Muslim is. But the basic principles of doing good, of living a humble life, of living and understanding the purpose of life. Why are we here on earth as human beings? And if we just see ourselves as individuals in this big, huge universe that we can only, as human beings, conceptually realize the enormity of, we are but a speck individually. And we are finite. We do die. Whether people believe in afterlife or not, we're not going to even discuss that. But so far, we don't know of any human being, since the history we know of human beings, that they've lived forever, because they don't. We always die. And so knowing that we end, it's precisely this realization that, why be egotistic about a nature that we have, which is bound to end? Why do we give such importance to us as human beings, as the individual, when you know that there's more than 7 billion of us, and this is just the human beings, not even counting the other living things that we're supposed to share this world with? So it's for me, it was a very natural thing that I am no bigger than who I am in my body and in my soul. And what I've discovered in my experience, and particularly this becomes a gendered thing too, The way world politics run, and unfortunately, we know the reality that most of world politics are run by men. And for men, it seems like this natural, I mean, I don't know if it's a natural phenomena, but it's been taught to them that it's only natural to be egotistic to be powerful. Somehow, ego is associated with power. And perhaps as a woman, I don't understand that.
Which is probably a good thing.
And then that's what I wanted to say, that actually, I don't regret not understanding that, because I don't see ego as power. Because what I witnessed in my short period of time at the Ministry of Education in Afghanistan, surrounded and working with men mostly through other ministries, or the majority of the cabinet was run by men. There was this incredibly vicious and ugly competition of taking credit. Because credit taking is it's part of the ego, right? You feed your ego through making yourself and others believe that you are capable of doing these things. And at the end of the day, my take as minister was, and I saw the struggle, and I saw not only people running and fighting for credit to show themselves politically to the president, to the cabinet, to the country that they had done this thing. My take from day one until day last was, as long as the work gets done, who cares who did it? I mean, really, at the end of the day, whether I remained a minister or not, my mission in joining the ministry was to serve the children of Afghanistan. And if I was going to place and put in place policies and procedures and mechanisms and, bring about the reform agenda that we had proposed of making the education system a better system for the country and its future through its children, why did it matter if I, Rangina Hamidi, did it, or if, thousands of employees that I had? Because at the end of the day, my tenure or my time at the ministry was going to end. The maximum that I would serve would be 5 years. And the maximum that I could serve was 5 years. After 5 years, I was going to be removed if I'd remained alive. So who cares who gets the credit? And so that, I think, is an important question to bring to not only conversations, but to disciplines, schools and universities and institutions that teach politics and that teach leadership and that teach, people, technical professions, to say, I mean, yes, doing good work is great, but if you're gonna go and be nasty about grabbing and crediting every little step you take to say, I did this to feed your inner, this ego, this call for feed me, feed me, feed me, then the whole purpose of your job or your action becomes just feeding this voice or this void, and not necessarily feeding the purpose of doing the great that you're supposed to. And I think that really, for me at least personally, that differentiates the notion of what a good leader is versus what's not a good leader. I can simply state that good leaders or natural leaders don't look for credit. To them, it's not important whether they get credited for work that they do or not, because the work that they do is from the heart. The work that they do is their passion. And when you work something that is your passion, then it matters not to feed in the ego sound internally to say, feed me because I want it, because you've already shut that voice up through the passion that you're working on. And so I think there's a lot of things at play where it's hard to teach passion to people, I think. I don't know if you can teach passion to somebody, but I think if people only followed their passions from within that they recognize as they're growing up, as they, join the workforce, they, if you I mean, my advice to listeners would be, if you follow your passion, the call that's internally calling you to be your interest, you will naturally become a leader in that, because you don't need to prove to anybody through a credit card system, through a credit scoring system.
Look at me.
Look at me. I've done all of this.
Yes.
Because your passionate work will lead its way to say, this person is good at doing this. And that in itself, whether you take the credit or not, whether you boast about your ego or not, that path will naturally take you to where you need to go.
So it's possible potentially to help someone spark their passion, but not necessarily teach it, to clear pathways for them to express it,
exactly,
but not teach them, because it's inherent. It's
absolutely
within them.
Absolutely.
Is a wonderful way to look at it. And that might be how ego is a tool, right? Because if it's already in there and you're not worried about getting credit, then you know you have a healthy sense of self.
Right.
Which is that healthy sense of ego. Like, I know who I am. I don't need your approval. I don't need you to validate me. So if you do or if you don't, it's okay. I'm fine with that. But I know who I am, and I know what I desire to do in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to keep moving toward that, because there's this passion that drives me.
Okay, so thank you for clarifying that. Now I understand how, where you can use it as a tool.
Yeah, and in what I've heard from you, it does seem like that's where it comes from for you, where there's just like this internal fire that takes you forward. To be a voice for women, to be a voice for children, to help individuals who have not had the opportunity to necessarily, they would speak for themselves if they could, they've just not been given the opportunity. And so if we can go back to when you returned to Afghanistan, when you returned there, what was your journey? What did you say, okay, I'm going to return and this is what I'm going to do? Or did you just go back knowing I'll find something to do?
I was young.
Okay.
Much younger than today, of course. I had the honor and the privilege of being raised in a family where my parents kept alive Afghanistan and its value system and our identity, the way they understood it, the way that they had lived it. And in a beautiful, natural way, they kind of injected that identity to us, even though living in America. So I'll clearly explain how. When we first arrived and then settled into our new home and started school, my father made a simple rule. When you come inside the house, you don't speak in English to each other. And he said, I know that English is a relatively easier language to learn and you will learn. But I don't want you guys to forget your mother's tongue, which is Pashto. And so we knew as children, even as young as 11, 12 years old, when we had arrived, and we had little brothers who were in their toddler age, we were forced to speak Pashto at home. And at that time, you know, as kids, you kind of want to rebel against it. But I'm so thankful to that rule, because that enabled me to retain my language, which helped me tremendously when I returned back in 2003. The general practice of food, of course, culture travels through its food, through its traditions and customs of marriages and ceremonies and births and deaths. So those are things that, even though we were living in America, we'd kept those traditions intact to the best of our abilities. And so when I went back, I went back with the stories of my parents, the stories and the emotions that they'd shared with me growing up, that this is what Afghans are like, you know, that history, that identity. So I felt going back, for me, it was almost this natural, like, I'm not going to anything that I don't know. You know, for me, it was just going to a home that was many thousand miles away. After 2 months of being in Afghanistan, I realized, I had this awakening almost. I said, I thought I was Afghan, but I have become Americanized. And I didn't know it until being on the ground for about 2 months after. And the realization was not so much the physical outer appearance, because I dressed like an Afghan, you know, traditional clothing. I covered my head. I prayed the prayers. I spoke the language. I ate the food. So not American in that sense, because I fit right in. But American in the sense of thinking. My thinking had changed. And this ability through the education system that I had received here in America, and I'm not saying that this is predominantly and only available in America, because my father was a product of older generations in Afghanistan who had been educated in Afghanistan, and he was very much an open thinker and a very, you know, open-minded person. So I know that the education system during my father's upbringing time frame was much different than what the past, say, four and a half decades have done to us as a nation and as a people. And so I realized quickly that I thought and I processed information very differently than my Afghan friends, family, and colleagues that I was on the ground with. But while it was an eye-awakening experience for me to know and be comfortable with the fact that I'm a dual citizen, really, in the true sense of the word. I'm Afghan because I can relate, I have history, I have the identity, I have my roots, and Afghanistan having those lineages, the roots to people who are known is an incredibly important element, and luckily I'm blessed with that, so I have that. But at the same time, I felt very much American. And so I think after having that realization, I realized that I'm a natural bridge between these two cultures. As I was trying to not battle, but teach my friends, my neighbors, my classmates, my colleagues about my culture and my identity as an Afghan citizen here in America, I realized that I started to do the opposite to my Afghan men and women that I was working with, that no, America is not what you know, the stereotypical image that is painted in the hearts and minds of people, that no, America is not like that. Americans are not like that. So it was very interesting to see that dichotomy at play. And while at the same time realizing that even the physical outer appearance that I tried not to pay too much attention to, I realized going back to Afghanistan that while covering my head, the way I'm clothed and the way I dress, while it's too much for America, going like this to Afghanistan, it was too little for Afghanistan. So not completely adapting to the whole separate life of women and wearing the burqa and trying to live a life away from the men in the society, the public men. That in itself proved me to the Afghan community that I was not Afghan enough, because I was completely comfortable with sitting with men and talking with men and working with men. And so there's always this dual, and now that I'm back, I'm replaying that. The clothes I wear, the languages that I speak, the experience that I have and the mindsets that I've learned about, just communicating that. Unfortunately, there is this perception in America that, particularly as the Taliban took over, some of the political narratives revolved around this idea of Afghans want elements like the Taliban. The great majority of Afghans don't want development. They don't like democracy. They don't want women's empowerment. And so if they want the Taliban, give it to them. But I know, yes, we might look like very, you know, people still living a couple centuries back from our dress code, from our attire, from the way we live our lives. But we're, as Afghan people, we're not close-minded to the point where we want extremist regimes like the Taliban to come and rule the nation. It was complete politics at play. Politics supported by guns with bullets that literally killed people. And when you have a bullet you know, pointed at your head, whether you agree or not agree, you're going to bow your head for the fear of being saved. And so when we use, you know, such rhetoric to say that people want extremist ideologies like the Taliban to come and rule them, I tell my American friends, I tell my colleagues that it's not as easy, and don't be as naive to think that that's what the majority wants. So just being that bridge, trying to understand both cultures and trying to be an advocate for both cultures simultaneously has been both an incredible journey, but also one that is painful, because you're constantly trying to go against what the perceptions are. And I'm sure you understand how difficult it is to fight against perceptions.
Yes. And to know where you fit then, because if you're part of both, but not fully either,
yeah,
there's a personal sacrifice.
Oh, absolutely.
That occurs there.
Don't even talk about sacrifices.
Yeah. And I don't know that, again, that's where ego comes into play, mm-hmm. because we're all so set on, no, my way is the way. Mm-hmm. But there is no single way. And you being that middle and all that you have sacrificed, in the name of, there is no one way.
No. And I wish people would understand the emotional trauma individuals like, and I'm not important. Like I said, I'm a drop in the ocean. I'm a speck in the universe. But to understand the emotional baggage that we carry in trying to understand. I recently read that, you know, while empathy is good, being empathetic is a really good thing. It's a good quality. It's a good virtue. It's a good anything. I mean, and now there's even this push, at least in the modern Western world, to teach children to be empathetic. And I see why. Because children have lost it, unfortunately. People have lost it. People have become, and, you know, being away for almost 20 years, coming back to the U.S., I'm appalled at the development this country has made, to be honest, and I'm critical of it. The young population of this nation, to me, is worrisome. This carelessness, this, you know, addiction to technology, to screens, you know, just at least when I was growing up about, you know, a couple, sort of 3-4 decades ago, partly because of our own experience and not having access to constant, you know, media source at the tip of our fingers, we did grow up with different values where we cared. You know, simple things as caring was there, whether it was your friend, your neighbor, your family member, an elderly. And I don't see that as much in the society anymore. But being empathetic also means you just have to build really, really strong shoulders, because it means you start carrying the world on your shoulders. And here's my dilemma as an Afghan woman. You know, there's this one narrative, there's only one version of, oh, the Taliban are horrible monsters. They're, you know, they're extremists. They hate women and they want to kill women and mute women. And all of that is, I'm not denying any of that. But I also want to challenge the world to understand, who are the Taliban? Have we ever asked those questions? What kind of homes did these young men grow up in? What kind of mothers, sisters, fathers, grandparents, love? Did they have any love as they were growing up? And then to be sent as a child because your family cannot afford to feed you, they send you across the border to go to a school where politics of your neighbors utilize that vulnerability and teach an ideology of extremism and one of violence and one of torture to kids as little as 7 years of age. We shouldn't forget that. The reason they've become monstrous in their behavior is because of their upbringing, of the political elements that have trained them to become as such. You know, as an educator, as a mother, as someone who only accepted the position of ministry, not because I wanted to be a politician. I didn't care for that title. I didn't care to be a minister. But when the president asked me the question, do you not want to give and provide what you're providing to your daughter to the rest of the nation's children? How can you as a mother say no? And so that was my reason for joining politics, not because I was interested in the seat, but because to me, I was asked to think of the millions of children of Afghanistan as my own. I'm blessed with a beautiful daughter. And it's that ego. I could not say, no, I'm only going to stick to my daughter and not open up myself to the other children of Afghanistan. But today, you know, this empathy also forces me then to question, why do we allow communities and politics to train young people, and then in our particular case, young men, and most of the time it is young men, unfortunately, to become so violent? Because we know, we definitely now know through research and enough experience that when a child is grown in an environment, in a home, in a society where he's surrounded by love and compassion and mercy, that child doesn't become violent. Violence is a ugly, vicious cycle that perpetuates itself. And so if we do know that there are political entities that are funded through sources that where we know where the funding comes from and taking advantage of poor children because their families cannot afford to feed them and train them to become the monsters that we see today, then how can I not have any sympathy for them? And how can I expect them to have the same democratic values and the understanding that I've had the privilege of here in America? This is, to me, we live in an unfair world where we know the reasons behind why things happen, yet we don't do enough about going to the core of the issue and only start penalizing people who are produced as a result of what that core is. And everybody knows where the core is. Everybody knows who funds the core. And yet, you know, politics prevent us from talking about it because it's not good. We don't talk about our allies in bad ways. We go blind. And this is what I hate about politics, is that politics turn a blind eye to the wrong and the wrongs that supposedly our allies do in the name of whatever they give. But we only start punishing the people who then start practicing what our allies have taught them to do. And to me, as much as I like to badmouth the Taliban today and say they're a horrible group and they're vicious and they're... And I believe all of that, but I also try to understand where they're coming from. And I cannot make that judgment call. As horrible as they are, I learned today that our women, not only is the question of allowing girls to go to school still at stake, it's we don't know, because we have until March 22nd to find out if girls will actually go return back to school from seventh grade and beyond, and whether the female teachers will go back to work or whether any female women working in Afghanistan in any sector will be allowed to go to work. And this is an incredibly painful thing for me as a woman to experience that. Sitting far away from here, I'm critical of it too. And I believe just yesterday or the day before news came out that now the new requirement is that if a woman does want to work in any field, in the sectors, in the fields that they will be allowed to, she has to completely cover her face, which is that complete hijab. And I'm personally, professionally, from a belief system point of view, I'm personally against that. I don't think my faith told me to cover myself completely. Yet here's a group of men who have come. And for them, it's easy to do as I say, because if you don't have the power to kill you or get rid of you, and they do have that power, because somebody somewhere has supplied them with the weapons and the bullets that are needed to shut people up. And we allow it. We allow it as a world. And then we wonder and we sit and we ask why we are in this incredibly sad and angry and violent world. Because we, our leaders, our politicians allow this. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Please do not be sorry for speaking from the heart. That's the whole purpose of this podcast. And it is only when we have the courage to speak our truth that others who share it will join together and things can be different. And you've shown tremendous courage. You were the first female minister of education in 30 years for Afghanistan. That's progress.
I remember when President Ashraf Ghani asked me to join his cabinet, I was completely surprised because I wasn't expecting that. I've never worked with the government. I didn't have any intentions of working with the government. I never saw myself as a politician. In fact, I always was one of the critics of governments. And I, again, some people say, well, it's women who begin to question themselves. And I think people are right. Because I now, in retrospect, if I can think of many of my male friends and colleagues, if they'd been asked to come join the cabinet, they would have jumped on the call and say, yes, absolutely. But I actually started questioning, not that I was not fit, although that was part of it too. I asked the president, ultimately, I said, why me? What do you see? What have you seen in me that, you know, with someone who has absolutely no experience in working with government structures and government affairs and how this whole system, whatever system, if any, works? And his response was beautiful and it spoke to my heart, which was, the education system of Afghanistan has consistently been politicized. And I want to depoliticize it. So precisely for that reason, I want to bring somebody who's not interested in this position for the political aspirations of it. And I think that, well, of course, that also created and gave me many critics. I developed very many critics very, very quickly, not only for being a female, but being from Kandahar, where I'm from, my ethnicity was at play, my gender was at play, the fact that I had never been in government, that was at play. And then the other, an issue that I know the listeners here would understand is the fact that I'd grown up in America became an issue too. How can you bring somebody who didn't grow up in Afghanistan? Well, it was not my choice. I was a little girl when my parents packed up and left. And nobody really questioned or paid attention to the fact that I chose to come back. I left all the goodness and all the wonders of America that everybody dreams of having in 2003 and left to go back. But some elements within the Afghan community, whether they're inside the country or outside of the country, living all over the world now as diasporas, they do become very critical and cruel and mean. Because without understanding your situation and your background, they start judging and criticizing. But that's part of sitting in a political seat. And that's what the previous president, who I respect dearly and look up to as a leader, as a leader of heart, honestly. I see him as a leader of heart, but also as a leader of intellect and knowing and understanding what is good for the country that he was leading. Unfortunately, politics also played around him and created someone that he's not out of him. Unfortunately, politics do that. But to be able to lead an institution as great and as big as and as impactful as the Ministry of Education as a female, and, you know, it's incredibly difficult and challenging time of 2020 to 2021, was not only not an easy task, but at the same time, it was very rewarding because it showed, for me at least, it showed to my nation that a woman is capable of not only to manage and lead such a great and huge institution, but that a woman can dare to step out of the definition of politics that men have defined. And while, you know, many people still argue against me, no, you cannot say that you cannot be a politician while occupying a ministerial seat. My challenge to the world now is perhaps it requires us to revisit the definition of politics. Can't we redefine politics?
I love everything about that statement. Maybe it's time to reevaluate the system.
Yes. You know, I'm studying now in the courses that I'm taking for my master's degree, but the world has changed. We're living in the 21st century, not because of just a number, but because of but the 21st century is so much different from the aspects of technological development, economic issues, the climate issues, you know, global warming. The climate challenge is real and it's upon us. And this new notion that I've learned about called Anthropocene, which looks at the impact that human beings have had on the world, the globe, the earth that we know it. It has changed. And so if so much change has come to us in 2022, and we know it, and we realize it, and we live it, why must we be stuck to believe in definitions that were made in the 19th or 20th century? Why can't we redefine what democracies are, what politics is?
We've modernized everything else.
Except for our understanding of politics.
Yes, I think it's about time.
Thank you.
So we would love to welcome you back to continue this conversation in future episodes. For now, we have reached the end of our time together, which saddens me greatly.
Well, I'm just around the corner. I'm in Phoenix, so call me anytime.
That would be wonderful.
You wish to. I'm happy to come. And I hope your listeners or our listeners enjoy our conversation. And if they wish to, I'm more than happy to come again.
That would be fantastic. Now, I have no doubt you'll have inspired a lot of young women around the world, because we do have a global audience. If they would like to get a hold of you, is it okay if they reach out either to us and we can forward Absolutely. The messages, or is there another way that you would prefer that they reach you?
If they reach you, it's probably the easiest.
Okay.
And you know how to get a hold of me. So I'm available, and I'm happy to answer anybody, but particularly my sisters and daughters across the globe.
Okay, wonderful. So you heard it here. If you would like to get a hold of Rangeena, you can send us a message here at info@suivera.org. We would be more than happy to forward them along, and she can respond to you as her schedule allows. Our tool this month, our free giveaway, is an ego alignment journal. It's a wonderful asset to assist in really understanding where your ego is and where you desire it to be, where that goal state might be. And then just simple tools to help you navigate from where you are to where you might like to be. Until next time, this is the Heart Leader Podcast, where heart and mind align. And I am your host, Amber. We look forward to seeing you in our Suivera community. You've been listening to the Heart Leader Podcast with your host, Amber, where heart and mind align. Tune in weekly on TransformationTalkRadio.com as we take a deeper dive into what it means to be a heart leader. Ready to take the next step? Join us and over 1 million people worldwide who've united in creating this global movement of love. Become a heart leader for today and tomorrow. Learn more and connect with us at suivera.org.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.